This is the first time I'm presenting these ongoing speculative, although I hope you guys find it interesting, unwritten thoughts as an outsider to the field. So, you know, please be gentle. So, okay. So let's start. So here's a picture I found. I think it's Dieter Zess' picture. And here's Niels Bohr. And he's guarding the frontier between the quantum and the classical world. And I don't know how he missed the opportunity to make this joke with the board, but maybe it's because it's not that funny. But so here, basically, this is, he says, do not cross without amplifier, Niels Bohr. And you have the cat there and classical law. And this is basically reflects what just describes Bohr's attitude with respect to the classical quantum divide. So to describe this divide, you see here the Schrodinger equation. And given almost any initial condition, the universe described by the wave function evolves into a state containing many alternatives that are never seen to coexist in our world, right? So this is actually, I should have put some quotes here because this is a quote for him. He says, our unease with quantum theory is the clash between the principle of superposition, which is, he says, the basic tenet of the theory reflected in the linearity of the Schrodinger equation and everyday classical reality in which this principle appears to be violated. So this is one aspect of the measurement problem. And for Bohr, that's the point that relates to the figure, is that the classical apparatus measuring the quantum system is a necessity. It doesn't really belong to the system. The quantum theory is not universal. It doesn't apply to the apparatus. But there are well-known alternatives. I'm going to be talking about one framework, which I find interesting from the background that I come from, which is quantum gravity. So let me give you a brief introduction to decoherence as it was more or less originally stated. And it corresponds to the loss of coherence or ordering of the phase angles between components of a system in quantum superposition. So one consequence of this is that you observe the emergence of classical probability or additive behavior. And so to be a little bit more specific, let's give here a qualitative example. If we let N here parameterize the states of the measured system, and phi naught be the initial apparatus state or the environment state, let's say, or as some people call it, the pointer basis state. And then if there's an interaction Hamiltonian, it will entangle the two in a certain manner. And so this the initial apparatus states evolves, or the environment evolves also with depending on the states. And what you see for the density matrix, it acquires a term that has an inner product between two states of the apparatus state. And if the states of the apparatus or of the environment are nearly orthogonal, you will observe a diagonalization of the density matrix. And this we can treat basically as classical probabilities if we take this into consideration. So this is the usual description of decoherence. And for me, I mean, consistent histories is just a way for me to as you'll see, to put this into a framework that I find more adaptable to configuration space, which is what the talk is about. So let me just also very briefly review what consistent histories is, just the basics. I'm not going to be talking a lot about consistent history frameworks and realms and all that, although I have some ideas about those things, but I don't think it's there at that level to be explained yet. So so consistent history, it's basically the purpose of this is to describe conditions that allows you to assign probabilities to different outcomes, to alternative histories of a system. So basically, it kind of wants to quantify that decoherence. When can we talk about history separately such that the probabilities for each history obey the rules of classical probability while still being consistent with the Schrodinger equation. And the sufficient condition that is described for this is that there's no quantum mechanical interference between different histories. Okay, so at first, slightly abstractly, I will exemplify this better in a little bit. But let these be projectors, okay, in the Hilbert space of whatever system we're looking at. And they're orthogonal projection operators. In my view, this would be basically projections or delta functions in configuration space that will project to particular moments of history. But so far, let's see this set of orthogonal projection operators. For example, one of these could be the position interval an electron might arrive at a screen time tk. Okay, so you separate your coarse grained screen into the different intervals, and at time tk, it could have arrived in a certain interval, and this would be a certain projection operators. And in consistent histories, they are taken to be exhaustive and exclusive. So basically, they should account for the possible descriptions that you're going to see in the system. This is exhaustive and exclusiveness is that no two of these things can one projects out the other. They're projectors. Okay. So now we're getting more towards what I want to talk about. So a particular history correspond to one particular sequence, let's say of these projectors, and a corresponding chain, right, of the projector operators. So let me give you here an example. Suppose I have two slits, one is upper and the other is lower, and one observer of the slits, he has to be included in the system in the consistent histories framework, and he is going to decide if he's going to measure or not measure, if he's going to block or not block one of the slits, let's say, and one screen, which is here, also coarse grained. And then one particular history, for instance, is, at time t1, the observer decides to measure it. Here, someone complained that mies sounds like measles, but this is measure. And part of that history, for instance, the electron goes to the upper slit and is detected in an interval of xi. This would be one particular history. What is the criterion of a set of histories to be consistent is that they have to decohere, okay? So basically, for any two different histories that you get, okay, I would like this expectation or the trace of this operator to approximate zero, in the sense that these histories are kind of orthogonal. And then you can assign classical probabilities basically to histories and say, okay, this is what this has happened with probability something, or this happened with probability something. And so this is all a preamble to my actual talk. This is basically where I'm going to start from, is the path integral form of that. And I'm going to have more to say about this, and I'm going to explain this a little bit better. Okay, here you should see gamma and gamma prime as being paths that basically they touch base on either alpha or alpha prime. So gamma touches base in each one of the alphas of this history, and the gamma prime touches base in each one of the alpha prime. And here's the action along paths that pass through the points of alpha in configuration space, and these are paths that pass through the points of alpha prime in configuration space. Okay, so what is configuration space? So now let's get to the main part of the talk. Okay, so configuration space is the space of all possible classical configurations of an entire closed system. This is at least the meaning of that I will be ascribing to them, okay? So you have to take into account all the points. For instance, there's no external time in what I'm describing. Time is a clock inside time is described also in the configurations. And so an example, simple example that everybody's plays around with at some point in undergraduate is the R3N for dynamics of three particles in R3. And in this sense, so partial configurations would be just, for instance, the position of particle one or one of the particles will define a submanifold in this configuration space. So it will describe a surface. If you don't care about the positions of certain particles, if you're just looking at some particles, that will describe this submanifold. Okay? So we can describe path integrals in configuration space. And you can describe a propagator of the amplitude from going from Q1 to Q2. These are 2 points. By the way, almost all my images are from the internet. I didn't really ask for permission. My images are as good as the internet, except for Flavio, who made some pictures for me. But so this is the propagator. Here, gamma is a path, is our curves that go in configuration space between Q and Q2. And classical behavior is basically regained from this if you think about a coarse graining, because paths that are close to one that is not nearly extremal, small variations of the action there will create very different neighboring paths with very different phases, so they cancel out. And basically, if you do a coarse graining, a path around a path that is not nearly extremal, that won't really contribute to the amplitude between coming from here and from there. And this is a crucial thing about what I'm going to describe to you. I know we've all heard this since Feynman, but it is important in the following. So let me make 2 further notes about path integrals in configuration space. So you can approximate paths by segmented classical paths. So basically, you do this and this, and then you can break this up further and things like that. And you can make successive approximations of paths through classical paths, and you can capture the theory arbitrarily well. And we usually consider classical paths as just geodesics for symmetric and configuration space. Okay, so this can't always be done. But so you have to think about configuration space. Let's say, maybe I should make this bigger. You have to think about configuration space as this big, big dimensional manifold, which just drawing it big here doesn't really convey. And where each point, for instance, is basically, it describes what is Q1. Q1, let's say, is the position of particle 1 up to Qn. And now I'm putting in a metric in this space, right? And if I have like a classical trajectory here, in this space, the metric that I put it in, that I put in the space, will describe it as a geodesic. Okay, so basically, I put in this type of, it's called the Jacobi metric, and it works, for instance, for particles with zero total energy. It involves the incorporation of the potential into the kinetic term. And this basically so describes the action here, or the action along a path, is basically the distance calculated with respect to this metric. Okay, but this is not always possible, but I will assume that it's possible, and so I'm basically trying to capture the action through the geometry.
So question, that the Jacobi metric just essentially captures the action as a distance measure.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
You can be more explicit. It just is the square root of minus the potential energy times.
Yes.
Why do you choose to do this and not just treat the path integral as a space in terms of space-time trajectories?
Because I don't want to talk about space-times. I want to talk about entire configurations. I don't want to talk about trajectories inside space-time, for instance.
Say that again? I didn't understand the distinction.
Well, you, from what I understand, you're describing paths inside the space-time. Is that what you meant?
Instead of just configuration space cross time, if you're doing a non-relativistic view, that's what the paths originally are.
But I want to describe a closed system where time is actually included as a variable in here, and basically it's a static picture in a sense. Yeah, I think it could become clearer.
I'm just asking why you're doing, but maybe it'll be.
Maybe if by the end it hasn't, we can talk more about this. So okay. Okay, so how do I represent superposition and decoherence in this picture? Well, all paths contribute from the amplitude from going from one to the other, or are superposed in a certain sense. And this is the sense that I'm talking here about superposition, is these paths contributing significantly to the final amplitude. So as we saw, the path integral form of the decoherence functional, as I just showed it here and didn't really explain anything, but this is the mathematical form of the decoherence functional. And as I said, each one of these paths will touch base on each one of the alphas, which is a history along a certain path. Now let's, you know, approximate decoherence. If you give a set of paths in configuration space between Q1 and Q2.
Sorry, you might have said this before, but are you assuming a fixed initial and final position?
Yes. Initial and final configuration, yes.
Okay.
Yes, in this sense they are. So here's Q1 and Q2. Okay, Q1 is not position of particle 1, so maybe that was a bad drawing over there. It's just, I should have written QI and QF, maybe. Okay. Representing this set of this history, I will say gamma I and gamma J approximately decohere if the difference in lengths is not approximately extremal. This is not a very, it's difficult to work with this concept of approximate decoherence. So I will introduce a different one that you can look at particular paths and it's easier to work with. So, oh, by the way, Rafael, before you came in, I also had a disclaimer that this is not my field. So this is, I'm just trying out something new and giving some thoughts on unwritten work and so speculative. So given a coarse graining of paths in configuration space between Q1 and Q2, I will define this as one of the paths fades, or one of the coarse grained paths fades, okay, to some order, let's say epsilon, if due to this dephasing or due to all these nearby paths canceling the phases of each other, it the contribution to the propagator is small, all right? And so basically, if you have here, I drew some paths. These paths, let's say, are nearly geodesic in this metric, so they will contribute to the amplitude from going from here to here, but in this coarse graining. But this path, for instance, here, you know, it would have a normal geodesic would have gone straight there, but I twisted it so that it's not a longer geodesic, and so it fades, and that's where I dotted the line here. It loses. The amplitude of it fades, basically, because it's not nearly extremal. So I'll say that coarse-grained paths are in superposition if they don't fade, okay? If they basically have the same amplitude, let's say, between two points. And for an example, there's this concept in Riemannian geometry, like the cut locus, which is a cut locus of a point are all the points, so let me draw it here. So the cut locus of this point are the set of points where geodesics emanating from this initial Q1 are no longer maximizing or extremizing. Okay, so for instance, on a sphere, the cut locus of a point is its antipodal. So you can see from this, for instance, in this geometry, paths that would superpose, for instance, all the paths that connect QI to its cut locus would superpose, because they don't fade, they're geodesics of the same length, basically.
So, a question about terminology here?
Sure.
So when you say coarse-grained paths are in superposition, do you mean two paths within one coarse-grained set are in superposition?
Yes.
Okay, and the sorts of objects that can fade are not paths themselves, but coarse-grained sets of paths?
That's right. So here's the problem, right? If I had just talked about a single path, right? A single path, there is no sense in which it fades. It has that e to the is. It has the same frequency. The sense in which you can say it fades is because nearby paths, if you vary it a little bit, nearby paths will have phases that are off phase with this, so they will kind of cancel. So that's the sense in which I put in a coarse graining here, is that you have to consider these swaths of paths around each one of these. But I don't know in which sense exactly it has to correspond to a...
And are you considering particular coarse grain sets? So when you specify your alpha, you're specifying projectors onto a subset of points in configuration space at various discrete times. Are you then saying take all those paths that pass through those subsets every time, and that's the coarse grain set we're looking at?
Yes, basically, I think so.
But then it's not necessarily a small epsilon region around a given path, because those projective regions could be large.
That's right. So okay, so here in the sense that I'm describing this, it's more. So I'm not sure I understand exactly what you mean, but so let's say here I have certain points here, Q1, Q2, Q3. And what I'm saying is, okay, let's take a coarse grained path. It's a little different. So coarse grained would be, I take a path here, but a coarse graining is like an epsilon, let's say, around it. Coarse graining of the path itself. And I could have another one that does this, and then a coarse graining would be, you know, something like this.
That sounds like the standard notion of kind of the H-bar ball of paths that we talked about in finite path integrals. But you started out with making this connection to consistent histories where we had, for example, the two-slit experiment, we have sort of the region of space at time one corresponding to coming out the aperture. At time two, we have the two regions of space corresponding to the first slit and the second slit. And at time three, we have a region of space corresponding to the input aperture of a photodetector. And so I thought you were talking about sets of paths, say, that all start out in the aperture, go through slit one, and arrive in the receptive aperture of the photodetector.
But they do.
Not
they
an H-bar ball, they, because the width of the slit doesn't have to be related to H-bar in any way. So I'm just kind of confused about what sort of coarse graining you're talking about.
Yeah, I think there's a terminological. There's probably the word coarse graining is sometimes used in two, maybe in this talk, even being used in two different ways.
Yes, probably. So I don't.
Kind of in the people who do consistent histories, they talk about coarse grained history. That can really be any set of histories. It doesn't define of these trajectories. It doesn't have to be defined by some epsilon.
Yes.
So they're basically just talking about a partition of the space of all histories.
That's right. And you shouldn't think about in configuration space. You're thinking about the size of the slits, right? Mm-hmm. But the size of the slits is not the size of this in configuration space. If you think about this in terms of
But you're also using coarse graining here in another way, which is just a slight fuzzing of an individual path.
Yes.
By an amount epsilon or delta. Or
yes.
Like
yes.
That. I guess your notion of fading has to do with the second.
That's right. That's right. But I can try to relate to.
In some sense, a special case.
That's right. That's right. But I can relate it to what you were saying, if you want, because look, if you think about this in terms of configuration space geometry, right? The actual length between the paths doesn't mean that the action between these paths is at a coarse graining configuration, is at a coarse graining distance in configuration space. Physical space doesn't correspond to to distance in configuration space. So for instance, the double slit, you know, you can imagine the slits here as having a high potential barrier, let's say. So if this was going to go through here, this would correspond to a large distance in configuration space. And this, so that if these paths go through here, they're going to be larger than an epsilon away in the coarse grained sense that I described there.
So just to get it clear, the coarse graining that you're talking about here in fading is not the coarse graining that people talk about in consistent histories.
That's right. Exactly. So I think the best way to think about this is, as Raphael said, just think about this little, what was it? This little
fuzzing.
Yes, that's right.
So if I've understood correctly, then these kinds of coarse grainings are always H-bar sized balls around a given trajectory.
I can say that, but yes. You have to think about H-bar size in configuration space geometry.
Okay. And therefore, when you say we will say that two paths within a given coarse graining are in superposition, the only things that can be in superposition relative to that definition are paths that are epsilon close to one another, and therefore a path that passed through slit one and a path that passed through slit two could never be said to be in superposition according to this definition.
No, of course. Look, the definition that I said is that the paths that arrive at a final are nearly geodesic. So the path that is in the center, let's say if you have this fuzziness, the paths that are in the center of this ball, they are nearly geodesic. Then I will say that they're in superposition. Because neither of them fades.
Wait, so it says we will say that coarse grain paths between Q1 and Q2 are in superposition. Do they have to come from the same coarse grain?
I don't understand exactly what sense are you talking about coarse graining.
So coarse graining is a little bundle of paths.
Yes. So, but
are you saying
no. Okay. So this is a different. So this is the confusion between the two notions of coarse graining. So one of the coarse graining is because I'm thinking about coarse graining as these different histories, right? These different things here, let's say of the history, and then I'm thinking about a different one as this here and this here. So what this is actually saying is basically this. If you can approximate one of the trajectories that passes through the, if you put any single line that passes through the points that I determined, let's say the alpha k or whatever it is, or just paths that go from here to here, and they're not nearly geodesic, they will have this dephasing going on because of the bundle of paths around them. And so they won't contribute to the amplitude from here to here. I'm not saying a lot, if you think about it. I'm just talking about this fading because it faded.
So the way you're expressing it is very confusing because you're talking about whether a path is nearly geodesic or not, determining whether it fades. But we established before that the kind of thing that can fade or not is not a single path. The only kinds of things that can fade or not are sets of paths.
That's right.
And sets of paths cannot be geodesics or not. That's
but
a property of a single path.
I know, but they are, of course, but that's what I mean. That's what I mean, that it's a bundle around, that path will represent a given bundle around it. That's what I mean by a coarse grained path.
Would it be clearer if we just talked about an individual path that's fading?
But it is. It is an individual.
And that would mean that the little
bundle around it does not interfere.
That's what I meant. I say gamma I fades, just a single path fades.
Within that little bundle.
Yeah.
And then what would we say about superposition?
So I'm saying,
I assume that the things that can be in superposition are pairs of paths.
That's right. So I would say that paths between Q1 and Q2 are in superposition if they don't fade,
so
if each individual path doesn't fade.
So neither one of them fades.
Yes.
So if one or both fade, then we say they're not in superposition.
So you've got superposition if you've got a series of these, a whole load of little bundles that that match the coarse graining in the consistent history sense, that don't fade.
That's right.
Multiple ones that all go through these points.
Yeah.
And the surrounding paths don't cancel out.
That's right. They don't fade. They contribute significantly there. And then I don't know what's going to happen there. I mean, they could superpose and cancel the whole amplitude, but I'm saying that they are superposing if they reach the final endpoint with more or less the same
So this definition does capture the idea that the path, one of the paths that passes through slit one, does superpose with the path that passes through slit two, because they're both.
Yes, that's right.
These sort of geodesic types of paths. But it also, I guess, implies that two paths which are sort of epsilon different and both pass through slit one are also considered to be in superposition, because they would be two paths that don't, neither one of which fades.
That's right. But then you have to see, I mean, where, so they have to also reach the same final endpoint, right? So if you have, yes. Can I?
Yep, thanks.
Sure. So, okay. So, you know, we can approximate curves piecewise by geodesics. So can successive approximations of contributions to this amplitude be parametrized by the number of breaks in geodesics in configuration space? And so, like, you know, if I break once, then it's going to contribute to second order or something like that. And the answer is not quite, because the angle with which you break can also play a role. Okay? So if it's a tiny little break, it might not influence the amplitude, the overall amplitude, that much. And because, or if it's a big angle, it can influence. And this is where Kirchhoff's formula appears. So this is Kirchhoff's diffraction formula in normal R3. And I'm considering here a point source, electromagnetic, of emitting a wave at frequency nu and wavelength lambda. And basically, you can calculate the amplitude at point P here by considering, this is Huygens' Fresnel principle, by considering a re-emission of the wave along the surface. But to do that in the right way, for each one of these, there is a decrease in the amplitude with which this point will contribute to point P. So this decrease is basically this 1 over cos of this angle of the break over 2. So for the Kirchhoff diffraction formula, so for the Huygens-Fresnel principle, you can see that this will describe waves from some overcontributions of classical paths. I'm just considering these are classical paths with phase, of course. But it gives you an angle-dependent decrease for each broken geodesic path. So this kind of reminiscent of path integrals, but more or less, right?
When you say break from geodesic.
I'm sorry?
When you say break from geodesic, we're talking optics here? Is that?
Yeah, so this is a straight line from this to here. It's a sphere. It's a straight line in R3, which is a geodesic in R3. And then a break is this. It's to get to point P, I need to consider this other trajectory, as if this is actually re-emitting another.
Sorry, just on this form, is this formula in some geometrical, sort of near geometrical optics approximation, or is it more general?
It's more general, actually.
It's more general?
Yes.
Is it an exact formula for any lambda?
No, what is it? I think it's exact for point sources. Yes. But I mean, I have to check. I know it is different, for instance, from geometrical optics approximation.
It's
because it has the phase.
It's going beyond.
That's right. That's right. And that's why I want to try to implement it in this study. Okay, so I mean, this is, as I said, this is all, you know, speculative, and this is not my day job. but so the idea is, can we implement something similar in configuration space? And I think, you know, this would be well adapted to estimating this extra fading if you think about these geodesics and these angles that they form, because these are all classically computable things in configuration space. If you have the metric in configuration space, it gives you the action between histories, right? So estimating the extra fading between paths, I should have said, from just geodesic properties in, extra fading between histories, yeah, from just geodesic properties in configuration space. So here I can just mimic that, and I'm given a sequence of points in configuration space and the whole coarse graining that we discussed, connected by geodesics, which are kind of like this, let's say, the central parts of this, because they don't fade, and denoting the angle in configuration space formed at each one of these points of the history by this. This is the one previous point in the history. This is the point afterwards. I can tentatively write this kind of fading. And this is the picture. So here are the points that I want my path to go through. And I will say, okay, to leading contribution, let's say I have geodesics connecting these things, right? But then this doesn't really tell me if this fades or not. I also have to think about these angles between these things to see how much it might fade or not, especially if I'm going to compare it with another such path in configuration space. Okay. So these here are just pictures of how I think about these decoherence effects in configuration space. So just to get a little bit of a better feel, for instance, imagine there's an initial point here and you have different angles emerging from it in configuration space. And you see these geodesics really like going away from each other more or less quickly. But if the angle is not that big, let's say if something if there's something tiny that have a different direction initially, then you can come back and superpose in a meaningful way. These are all geodesics. But to actually try to, if something went far away, I will say it decohered, because to get back to here by a path, I would need a break and a highly non-geodesic character in the sense, or a large angle. And here is a picture that I think might be more appropriate, because this is basically just a projection of the hyperbolic plane. And here you can see much faster decoherence, right? These planes are going really fastly away from each other. And to reconnect them, actually, there's this angle of parallelism, which you can't reconnect them if the angle is not smaller than that. So there's a certain point in which. But so here, this also you should think, if you have an infinite dimensional configuration space or a very high number of dimensions, paths that are not nearly in the same direction that point away from each other too much, the space is too big. They can't reconnect back through nearly geodesic piecewise parts. So this is just illustrative of the way. So for instance, for complex systems, for chaotic systems, small differences in initial direction will quickly diverge will very quickly decohere in a sense in this configuration space, because they can't get back together anymore, or it's very unlikely they will contribute they will fade to high order. So this is what I mean here: the geometric character of the Jacobi metric should, for complex systems, be highly hyperbolic. So this is in a sense kind of like defocusing, you know, in GR, you have this focusing theorem if you have positive energy, where bundles of geodesics kind of focus together. I'm saying maybe, hey, if you put this Jacobi metric in this configuration space, maybe you should have something the opposite, that kind of runs away from each other. And that's why we observe decoherence at such short times. OK. So now I just wanted to present like a couple of examples that illustrate the way that I think this can be useful. Let me erase this. And then I'll conclude. How much time do I have?
I got another 25 minutes.
All right, good. Okay. So, and at least again, at least from what I understand of this paradox, you have an originally entangled electron-positron pair, and it goes through a beam splitter here. And it goes both ways. And if you forget about the right-hand side, let's say this comes over here, and if both paths come with the same phase, they interfered, I don't know, destructively, and this thing is always activated, the D+. And if only one path appears, for instance, let's say I block this, then the C+, the constructive for thing will shine. The detector will be activated. So here's the puzzle: is that if you now considered both sides, right? And I considered this history going through here, I can tell you if this detector here was lit, I can tell you that if I put a measure here, I will detect that the electron was here, because I know it couldn't have gone here, because this path has interfered with this one. This is part of what they call these non-destructive measurements, right? And this is a paradox, and because what happens is if you turn both on, you can actually, you find that sometimes both these are activated, which is a paradox if you think about the real thing happening in the background. So let me try to explain this in terms of configuration space. It's not very, it's actually going to be a bit silly, really. So I have in configuration space, I have a beam splitter here. I have four paths leaving this point Q1, which is that configuration BS1, BS2. I basically have four paths, and which I have termed V plus, V minus, and so on and so forth, and W plus, W minus. And W minus is the only one, actually, that doesn't reach the final point, right? Because this path here is the only one that annihilates if they both went through there. And so you can see in configuration space, it diverged. If it were to go back, it would fade. So basically, I have what you need to get interference for, what you need to get both D plus and D minus is just that these two paths here, where are they? Yeah, that these two paths are in the mix, basically. Because these two paths, you can see that W plus and V plus are there. So where is, yeah. Oh, so here, so unfortunately, the Wikipedia figure that I took this from, they changed W plus to U plus. But you can see that W plus and V plus are there. So sometimes they will reach it. And you can see also that V minus and W minus are there. So sometimes they will also reach it there in V plus. This is not quantitative. This is just a qualitative picture in configuration space and how these things, if you see them in full configuration, at least I don't see it. So my picture in configuration, as I will make clear now in conclusions, is that there is no real thing. The path didn't take this or that or this, but it's just this. Some paths contribute, superpose, contribute to a final amplitude or not. And you can trace this out as geodesics in configuration space. Oh, this is a more complicated one. Should I go through it? Yeah, OK. So OK, initially, let's say there's an orthogonal polarized photon production here. So let's suppose this is in the x-axis or y-axis going two ways, OK? So just consider that. And I mean, this side could be x or y. So let me do that here. This could be x or y. And this side could be y or x. They're always opposite. And originally, there's just the two slits here. So if I think about this in terms of configuration space, I will have four paths, basically. I'll have just this and this, and this and this. And this point here, this is, let's say, x on this side. Let's say this is xp, I think. It's there, xp, yp, xp, xs, ys. And here's xp, here's yp. And for each one, you can see there are two paths, because that's where they go in the around the in the double slit.
X and Y represent polarizations, or what?
Yes.
The two possible polarizations.
Yes. And in this picture, you can see, well, OK, so for each one of them, you're going to have some interference pattern there. This is the picture that you have. OK. So now the next step in this experiment is, OK, originally we have interference. That's what I said. Now, what they do is they stick in quarter wave polarization plates here. So that, let's say, if this is x, For instance, this will turn x, this will start x to be circularly polarized in one direction and in another direction, so that the just the x itself now don't interfere anymore. I wrote here red and blue because it's easier to visualize. Okay, so let's suppose I have a red, blue, red lens and a blue lens here for x, but it does the opposite with y. Okay, so for I'll show you in this in the bottom thing here. So let's say if x goes through, I have here is red, here's blue. They don't interfere anymore. And but I still I haven't written down what y does. So if I have ys, it does the opposite. Let's say here now it's blue, and here is red. This is what these things are meant to do. The y itself doesn't interfere with, the y itself won't interfere anymore, but you could, in principle, get interference between y and x, between the two different. So let's see what this looks like in configuration space, because it becomes much clearer. Okay, so, all right.
Just to be clear, what are the variables in configuration space here?
So the variables here, okay, so you mean what parametrizes? Okay, so this is xp, for xp, and this is upper slit, down slit, let's say, for xp, in that side. Or red, yeah, now that I put the thing, it's red and blue, but now they don't go to the same point in configuration space because they have different colors. So they're no longer going to the same point in configuration space because basically they have different colors, so they don't end up in the same final configuration. Right.
So what is a point in configuration space here?
It's a configuration.
Right, but what are the configurations?
So it's a red dot here or a blue dot here.
Okay.
Okay. I'm just simplifying in terms of colors because but you see here, red and blue.
So a point in configuration space is a location in physical space.
No.
Space of two particles. Together with a color, two colors.
Yes. Yeah, you should, exactly. I mean, you should think of a point in configuration space as a description of the whole universe.
So it's like eight dimensional here. You've got three points in space for each of these particles. And color is that? Just trying to understand what the.
So you have two particles, so that's six dimensional, and then there's. I don't know, the colors are discrete or continuous.
No, the colors are discrete in this case.
Discrete, so
you just have
one
different, yeah.
So it's sort of four copies of.
Yeah, this is exactly what I wrote here. And you can see that so far, there's still no interference because the XP and YP are in different places. Although this is it's hitting the same place on the surface with blue as this, the XP and YP are in different surfaces. But if you put a scrambler for the P, basically, that will project x and p to the same point. It basically is just a diagonal lens that will project different polarizations into that diagonal. Then I equate these two points. So that's now what I have is this. I will equate these two points. And now what I have is basically red connecting with that red and this blue connecting with this blue. And now I will observe interference. And this is what is observed. And this, I mean, when you go through it, it's quite difficult to go through the state description of this. So let me just finish. So what happens is you have this complicated system with entangled photons going each way, and there's no interference if you forget about this detection here, because these two sides are in different configurations, so they don't arrive at the same configuration, final configuration anymore. Because, like I described in this case here, these two sides are in different configurations, so they won't arrive in the same configuration anymore. But the thing is, if you put a scrambler before the P detector, it's another 45 degrees, then you recover interference. And this is very, I think at least, for me it helps to look at this picture, just these lines, and now they are, you can see that actually they match up across each other, so basically, this is just qualitative examples of this. Okay, let me finish because I'm super thirsty.
But it looks like an interesting experiment.
Yeah,
operationally, what is the experiment actually? Do you set this thing up?
Yes.
And you don't put a scrambler.
You don't put a scrambler here. You set this thing up. You don't put a scrambler here. You don't put lenses. It's not lenses. It's something that. That's exactly quarter wave plates. That's that. The electrons acquire circular polarizations. And then you observe interference because, as I said, it doesn't really matter what this side is. It's just a normal interference pattern, right? But then if you put this for each side of the S now, they will acquire different circular polarizations. So if for a single side, for a single X here, let's say a single polarization of the photon, they won't interfere anymore because now they are orthogonal.
So you put no lenses and no scrambler, you see interference.
That's right.
You put lenses but no scrambler.
You don't see interference. That's right.
And now you put lenses and a scrambler.
And you see interference.
You see interference again.
Yes.
Phenomenological statement.
That's right.
Experiment.
Yes. And yeah, for me, it's just my way of thinking that I think it's easier to think about these things actually reaching the same final configuration in configuration space. Okay, so let me finish with the discussions. The emerging picture that I think about is, it's almost similar to Everett Wheeler, but I don't really think of paths diverging in an initial path or something like that. I think all points in configuration space simultaneously exist. They're all there. There's no external clock. They're just configurations sitting there. Okay, and all you can do, given Q1, again, I make these remarks. I don't know if it's all you can do. This is my view. All you can do is, given Q1 and Q3, for instance, if you say configuration Q3 has a record of configuration Q2, if all the non-fading paths have to go through Q2. This could be a definition, right? So that means just like, look, I have a record, a really strong, I'm just defining a record. I have a record that my name is written on this board, on this chalkboard. That means that almost if I'm sure that there was a configuration, if I start from some initial configuration and I end up if I started up in a configuration where the talk started, and I end up in a configuration where I have written, my name is written on the board, I will say that it has a record if almost all the paths that contributed to this final configuration had me actually writing on the board. This is basically what I mean by a record in this sense. Okay, because other ones that didn't have me write where this just spontaneously emerged will be fading paths. They actually didn't contribute with a good amplitude. So in this sense, what I mean is that maybe, you know, there is no underlying quantum state of the universe. There's just conditional probabilities based on records, as I said, yeah.
So these paths now are not to be interpreted really as histories, but they're just ways of relating different points. The fact that Q3 would have a record of Q2, these paths are just formal devices for saying that? Is there a history anymore of the universe?
I guess you could interpret it. Like, I'm just saying, the problem is, what is Q1, right? Where did I start that from? But I'm just saying that if you can say that Q3 has a record of Q2, if I knew that all my states started, the universe started at Q1, let's say, I knew that all the paths or the histories that contributed to the amplitude at Q3 had to pass through Q2. Contributed significantly, right? Non-fading. So the point of view here is that each configuration is completely classical. And this is also something that I want to emphasize. The quantum character, it actually makes itself felt by interference between these histories, these paths. It's not really, like, if you think about a brain state, right? A brain state is entirely inside a configuration. Your brain is in a state right now. It has this bunch of connections. And it's entirely described by the configuration it is in. The question, why we observe a classical world, for me, in this picture, would really have no meaning. Because you can't observe classical superpositions. Your brain is in one of these configurations. What you can observe is interference between different histories. But the, for me, this meaning is, you know, configuration space is a classical object, if you think about it. It's just each point there has the whole configuration of the universe. Now, what about gravity? So in this sense, people talk about gravitationally induced decoherence. And I think, I mean, sure, in this respect, there's nothing really special about the gravitational field in itself. Geodesics in its configuration space would diverge rapidly due to nonlinearity, or would just diverge rapidly. So if you think about configuration space of gravity, it would also diverge. There are subtleties, as I will explain here, because this was a non-relativistic description. And the problem with gravity and foliation invariance is that paths that that intersect in one foliation might not intersect in a different foliation, right? So here's a I don't know if I mean if people are in quantum foundations since are used to this picture of gravity, or maybe I'm using jargon of quantum gravity. This is a horrible picture. But the thing is that the surface of simultaneity or the Lorentz invariance, you can foliate these things differently. And when you look at the path, so imagine this is a universe, this is a space-time. And I can describe the evolution, the configuration of this space-time in the way that I'm describing it is would be like a family of metrics. Let's say G of t, t is going this way, right? Now, I can describe the same universe. So this is a path in configuration space, this G of t. But now I can describe the same universe with a different foliation. And the path might not even the same universe could have no intersection with the original path. So this would be a problem. So this is where, for instance, for gravity, you have to take this into account. And basically, and this comes back to tell me, basically, because I was treating it as a quantum mechanical system in configuration space, where you don't have this kind of foliation invariance.
Just I want to say, if I understand your point, you could have two different four metrics, two different space times.
No, the same four metrics.
The same four metrics. I thought you were talking about whether two paths.
But I'm talking about the configuration space that I'm talking about is the family of three metrics.
Right, I know. Yeah. You could have two paths through the configuration space.
That describe the same four metrics.
Each one would describe a four geometry.
Yes.
At least if we gave laps and shift information. Then you'd have these two four geometries. You're saying you might slice them up in one way, and you find no slice on which the three metrics are equal or isometric. But you might slice them up in a different way.
Yes.
And then you might find a slice.
Yes.
In this one and a slice in this one, which the two, three metrics.
Yes, I will. Yeah.
Isometric.
That's right.
That's the point. Here.
That's the point. I was making it an even stronger one that, like, if you think about a single universe, you know that a curve is intersecting with itself at every point, basically, and you think about a different foliation of the same universe, this original curve in the same configuration, based by
mine. Yes. Slices where the three metric is the same.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you might slice it a different way.
Yes.
And it would be different. The three metric would be different on different slices.
That's right. Yes.
Which is telling us to look at the four geometry.
Exactly. Yes. I know, but I mean, that's what I have. So exactly, this is telling us to look at. But this other work is telling us we should look at different formulations of gravity that don't have this. Right. So this is a different point of view. So this is what, like say, Einstein ether or Hojava or shape dynamics are theories that don't have foliation invariance. But you still have to look you still have to look. I'm going to talk a little bit. Let me just hold myself, and I'll talk a little bit about this. So the problem with path integral for gravity involves this gauge integration over foliation slabs, which complicates the reduced phase space interpretation, sorry, configuration space interpretation that I was giving. And also, I mean, there are other questions, right? For instance, the action of the Hamiltonian, you can't really reduce the dynamics of gravity in this way to configuration space because the Hamiltonian, the flow of the Hamiltonian depends on the momenta. So it doesn't actually just reduce to a vector field on configuration space. But anyways, so theories whose solutions are uniquely determined by a point and direction in reduced configuration space are said to obey by the Poincaré principle. This is Julien Barbe's definition. And this is kind of the theories that I'm looking for that would be well described by this mechanism. Because so what I'm saying is that this doesn't happen. If I go to configuration space, each curve there just represents a bona fide solution, you know, a classical solution. Each solution of the thing corresponds to a geodesic, let's say, or a solution of the equations of motion. So where was I? Okay, yes, so this is the last thing that I think I want to say. Even for preferred foliation theories that are classically, even for a preferred foliation theory that is classically indistinguishable from GR, maybe can we use this formalism to infer qualitative quantum differences, such as different interference patterns for non-local measurements due to the preferred simultaneity surface? So for instance, if you have more breaks, can something reach a final point in configuration space, but if you look at it in GR, it would have a different interference pattern or something like that? Just simple, what I mean is by qualitative, I don't want to do high energy things. I just want to look at interference patterns of non-local things that are maybe require a break, one break. And see, again, this is all tentative. This is just, I'm just saying that maybe, you know, we can have other types of these non-local interference measurements, like the Walbert thing that I showed, that could reveal some inkling of this preferred foliation structures, especially if you look in this picture. For me, this seems at least possible. So there could be qualitative differences between considering quantum subsystems in a fixed background and this quantum mechanical behavior of the whole universe, of the whole configuration space, where there is kind of like this preferred simultaneity surfaces. It wasn't my last comment, so sorry. These are the really last comments. And just a summary. I have discussed the quantum mechanical description of closed universes. The description is spatially non-local, since each point in configuration space is a configuration of the entire universe. And in that context, we have formally, in the meaning of not formally, relied on a path integral formulation in reduced configuration space. I have assumed that the formalism of consistent history might be enough to detect decoherence and superposition to different orders of approximation. And this is the thing that I was saying again, but I want to emphasize, is that each configuration is completely classical. And the quantum character in this picture makes itself felt by interference, not in each configuration. We tend to think about things inside space-time. And that's why I think that we think about these things like, can I observe a macroscopic superposition? And I think that if you imagine, if you picture these things as happening for the whole universe in configuration space, these paradoxes don't really arise. The points in configuration exist simultaneously. All we can talk about are conditional probabilities based on records. And then this last point that I made, maybe we can derive qualitative predictions for preferred foliation theories. All right, thank you.
Questions? Well, I have a couple. In the place where you were talking about Huygens' principle and the deviation from rectal.
Yes.
Motion.
You want me to go back?
Yeah, could you?
Sure.
So there you were as I understood it, attempting to come up with a kind of quantification of the degree to which something is fading.
That's right. By broken geodesics.
Right. So in, if I think of just the regular Feynman path of co-formalization, in the limit that the action of the system is arbitrarily larger than h bar, it's only at the extremum that I get constructive interference. And if the action is finite, then it's the relative size of the action to h bar that determines, you know, how much fuzziness there is about the classical trajectory. So my question is, how do I connect this idea of deviations from where does h bar appear in this sort of picture of what's going on? Because it seems like it has to.
Yes. Okay. So I mean, that's right. So. So I didn't really talk about the phases, right? The phases of these paths. So basically, what h bar would appear in the same way as if I have this metric, this action. So h bar would associate to each one of these paths, that this coarse grained, let's say, a wave, and basically it connects the length of the path in configuration space with the phase of the wave that I'm assuming superposes in the same way. So this is very similar to here, right? I mean,
can't you just say, I mean, the phase is either the IS over h bar.
Yeah.
Right? So there's h bar.
Yes, exactly.
That's the regular path into both expression, but this expression for u of p here.
So this is a classical electromagnetism, just the potential there, right? I mean.
I took it that you were proposing that we could do Feynman path integral calculations differently from the way we're accustomed to doing them, wherein we use these sorts of formulas involving deviations from geodesics.
Well, yes, that's right. If I know that I can approximate the paths that contribute the most, right? Let's suppose I put a blockade here, or something like that, and I want to something like that. And I want to approximate, if I know that only, let's say, two paths or a broken path contributes to the final amplitude, then this formula would be equivalent. I don't mean to replace Feynman path integrals, but I think that in most circumstances where we use these things, or we can use these things in simplified context in which you only need to consider these broken geodesic type things, and then I think you can try to implement this this dephasing or by just considering angles between these broken geodesics.
Are you asking if we think of classical optics, just not, I mean, by classical, I mean not quantum, just the Maxwell's equation. How can we see that in path integral language? Is that the question?
No, I guess I. Although these examples are from optics, I thought the suggestion was, and we can do the same thing for mechanics. We can use these formulas to get a calculation for the amplitude that we would see in a double slit experiment with some atom. Was I mistaken about that?
Well, no. So
you are talking about quantum. You're not trying to do just classical optical calculations. You're trying to do calculations in quantum.
Yeah, but this is a calculation for. Okay, so if you would like to put it like that, this is a calculation for wave phenomena. Right, and I'm trying to reproduce something in between wave phenomena and particle phenomena by this. So I'm trying to introduce these trajectories, which are kind of like a geometrical approximation, but they come with a phase and they come with a decrease that, in the end, reproduces an aspect of wave phenomena. I think that's the nice thing about this Huygens-Fresnel thing. Yesley?
Yeah. You're done with that too. Well, comment on the question. If since you're using the Jacobi form of the action, can you just scale h bar into the metric in the configuration space?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what implications that has.
But. Yeah. So, I mean, tentatively speaking, you could think, I don't know, I mean, so here's one thought that's also very tentative and speculative, but the
answer is yes.
Yeah,
yeah. Does that have any implications? Yeah, I don't know. So What I was going to say is that if you think about a very large object and it's going in a geodesic, and you think about a break in a geodesic where it's no like, you know, it's falling in a different geodesic all of a sudden, if it's a large object, that will mean a large angle in this paths and configuration space. And if it's a small object relative to the whole universe, and there comes in this relational thing, relative to the whole universe, a small object, a break in its natural trajectory would incur only a small break in this angle of this broken geodesic. So there might be some relation there between H Planck and between the relation of the of to the whole, you know, of the size.
That's related to Rutherford. The second question is more general. I think I understood how in this language you would be able to talk about things that definitely did happen, or definitely will happen, and things that definitely don't happen. But the subtle part of effort interpretation has to do with when you try to derive the probabilities in the Born rule.
Probabilities what, sorry?
And the Born rule.
Ah, yes. So yeah, I didn't say anything about that. No, I don't. No. Yes, I agree. I mean, that's the Born rule is I didn't approach that, to be honest.
Okay, but if your viewpoint is really useful, then I mean, the many worlds interpretation, well, it's controversial, but some people would say that it fails to reproduce the piece of how they perform.
I don't know. I think about, like I said, you know, I think about this in terms of amplitudes from going from one point to another. And I think about these in terms of conditional probabilities, but I haven't thought about the norm. Yeah, I don't know.
It seems like there's three rather different things
going on.
Going on, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Three, anyway.
Like I said, I'm sorry if it sounds confused. It's just, you know, these things.
One of them is a sort of technical question of how can we make sense of fading versus non-fading paths. Another one is how to solve the measurement problem or how to solve the interpretational question of quantum theory. And the third one is what does it have to do with gravity?
Okay, yes. So that's right.
Now, let me ask about the first one.
Okay.
Because some of the, at least the third one, the gravity, it seemed to be driven by the idea that you must be working with paths in configuration space. Now I understand why you wanted paths in configuration space, because you can talk about angles between them. But couldn't it be, or have you considered whether the same thing could be done in space-time? I mean, suppose we talk about trajectories in space-time, or some higher, some configuration space cross-time, in the non-relativistic case. Do you think you could be able to define some sort of angle between them? I mean, are you sure you couldn't do the same thing here with the breaks and so on that would allow you to define fading in that case? And if you could, I would guess you could, and if you could.
But for me, the other thing that is really important is these explanations, these, you know.
Those explanations, that's the point. Maybe that's the fourth thing that's right, which is the most important one, which is that a lot of these paradoxes look less paradoxical, or at least they take on a new form when you think in the path integral language.
In configuration space.
Well, I don't want to add in configuration. I don't see what configuration space is doing for it. When you think in a space-time, I would say,
but
path
then
integral is really, in its origins, a space-time
yes,
viewpoint.
Yes, that's right.
So when we take that path viewpoint, as opposed to a wave function evolving in time viewpoint, which is that of the many worlds, for example. When we take the path, the trajectory or the space-time or the path integral viewpoint, the paradoxes become more transparent, I would say. Whether they're resolved is another question.
Okay, so let me.
So that, but if you accept that that's what you've shown, then I don't see why it has to be in configuration space, why you have to eliminate time.
So, okay, so I think, at least for me, for instance, this experiment is a good illustration of that, is that it is easier to see just qualitatively, you can see it, if there is going to be interference or not, if two histories reach the same final configuration. And if they don't, there's no interference.
So this is the question of when do histories interfere?
Yes.
It is true that in quantum mechanics.
But you see, this is non-local.
It is true that they interfere when at some final moment that you might introduce arbitrarily, that they reach the same point in configuration space. So that's true. So that plays a role. And that's I agree that's important. But
okay.
Still, we're talking about interference of space-time.
That's right. That's right. But part of this whole thing is motivated by, you know, Julian Barba's relational approach, that you think about the closed universe as a whole and these paths. And also, I mean, the way that I want to think about this as my brain being part of the configuration.
Space time is, when you think of space time, you're thinking of the universe as a whole. I don't
okay.
see the distinction.
For me, it's not intuitive in the sense that this is. For instance, even EPR paradoxes, you know, in this sense, it's very intuitive because it's just one configuration that contains the two pairs. And I don't know in space-time how these non-local aspects become less intuitive for me in the path integral, in the space-time path integral formalism. But we can talk about this.
Yeah,
later.
Do you mean space-time like four-dimensional space-time or configuration space plus?
Well, in the context of gravity, I would mean real space-time. In the context of this kind of discussion, it means just configuration space plus time.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Sorry, but also in gravity, even in general relativity, here a big simplification is given by the fact that you're considering configuration space, which is higher, an higher dimensional object, and its topology and geometry determines whether there is an interference or not. So,
space-time,
as a four-dimensional object, might be,
we don't know the rules for interference in quantum gravity. That, to me, that's one of the key issues that's not.
But yeah, but
I'm saying is that even in GR, to expose this sort of simplifications, I would expect you to need to use something like a configuration space plus time in some sense, or a generalized configuration space.
No, I suppose you just considered
not a four dimensional object.
But you consider four geometries with boundary, and you say that they have to be sewn together on their final boundary. That's the rule for interference.
This is very important. The difference is very deep. It is the universe considered as a unit, as a unity here. It is in the sense that it is a single point in a large space. The state of the universe is a point in configuration space. Okay.
That's an ideology, but that's not something that you have to do. To have the viewpoint of the universe as a whole, it's not necessary to consider a 3+1 split and some configuration space in which it represents a point. It's not a single point either if time is real. It's a trajectory through that, and we just saw the ambiguities in the trajectory.
No, but each instant is a point, right?
Yeah, each instant is a point, but you're forcing it into this, you're forcing general relativity into this non-relativistic framework. You may or may not find that fruitful to do, but I don't think you can claim that that's required in order to see the universe as a whole.
No,
conceptual advantage in looking at these diagrams is because of a higher dimensional configuration space and seeing any solution as a trajectory in this space.
How is that an advantage over a solution being a four geometry?
Can I just, are there any more questions? Because we probably should wrap up fairly soon.
Yes.
So if we could continue the debate and just, yeah, Rob.
So I'm reminded of Julian Barber's views on quantum mechanics a little bit by what you're saying, but maybe yours are slightly different. So if I understand correctly, you want to say, okay, time's an illusion, there's just a configuration space point, and there's sort of the illusion of time is contained in that configuration space point because the configuration of things holds a record of the past. And I see you as proposing a particular way of formalizing how to figure out, you know, what records are contained there by you apply your algorithm. You say if some configuration had to be along every past trajectory that could have led to that point given the initial condition, then we say that that configuration has a record of that past. But how do you, so that will allow me to pick out a set of kind of possible records. So like if I have a cloud chamber with the spherically expanding wave packet, and you know I see a track to the cloud chamber, I can do this sort of conditional inference you talked about. You know, given that I see that track in the configuration, it has a record, it has sort of the illusion of a particle right. following this
yeah,
track.
Yeah, the Clown Chamber is a perfect example.
But how do we get the fact that it's this particular trajectory we see, not that one, and these particular probability distributions?
Yeah, so I mean, exactly. So there will be other points in configuration space that exist in the same sense as we saw this that are seeing the other one. In that sense, it's close to many worlds, I would say, because these points in configuration space also exist. They're also there, and they also have their given amplitude, given energy state.
So then I think you will be facing the same sorts of problems that Lee was talking about, that many worlds has a lot of difficulty justifying the Born row probabilities for different configurations being observed. And I think if you're imagining that all these things are happening in parallel, probably have the same.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm imagining them in a certain sense as, yeah. Maybe, I have to think about that. Yeah. I'm imagining them in a certain sense already happened or already there. You see, they're already there in configuration space. And given an initial configuration, initial point in configuration space, where you calculate the amplitude towards any other point, then you would see this, how likely or not, or you know, the wave distribution. But I don't know what the Born rule is.
Let me try to make just a helpful remark. I mean, I think it's very interesting, it's very beautiful what you're doing, but you're just at the beginning. People used to correct me if I'm wrong, but people used to imagine that from something like the Everett interpretation plus some things about where the wave function vanished, one could derive, pull out the whole probability interpretation without use of the inner product or the norm. And I think on more consideration, though Bob Roche, for example, had some papers, Jim Harlow, I think, had some papers in which they tried to do that, from just what definitely would happen or definitely what would not happen, pull out the whole probability interpretation. But I think it was found that without taking into account that there is a norm. Without taking into account that there is a norm, the structure of the inner product, those programs failed to extract the Born rule or to extract a consistent notion of probability. Now, it doesn't mean that you won't fail, but it's an issue.
No, sure, of course
not.
It's exactly because of this that I wanted to
yeah.
give
nowhere
to
in
stop.
Your discussions you mentioned the inner product.
I'm sorry?
Nowhere in your discussion did you mention the
I didn't, yes.
So
I just,
that leads you to say some things about things that definitely did happen in the past or definitely did not happen. But whether you can go from those definites to probabilistic statements is the issue about whether you recover quantum mechanics. And without explicitly introducing somewhere in your structure the inner product, nobody has been able to do that. Now, there are also additional problems, but even when there isn't an impact, there are additional problems with extracting probability correctly from the Everett interpretation. That since you're thematically like the Everett interpretation, you might look at.
Okay, I will. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I was talking about these amplitudes and things having small contributions to that. I suppose I was just thinking about taking the module of the amplitude from.
That would come up with you. What does small mean? Small means small in the norm.
Yeah.
And then you. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, okay.
Lots to talk about.
Yes.
All
right.
Let's thank Henry Gergen.
Thank you.